Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Nancy Rose Ritter. Rose Ritter is the author of Living Tibet, the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. She's also an addictions counselor and is a founding member and a Buddhism class leader of the Goldenrod Center of Philosophic Studies near Watkins Glen. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you.
And you wanted to say something.
Yes. Before we begin, I'd like to talk a little bit about a concept in Buddhism called interdependence. If you're reading a book, you're looking at the pages. The pages are made of paper, and we are dependent on the paper, which is dependent upon the forest, which is dependent upon the earth, dependent upon the worms in the earth, the birds in the trees, the animals around, dependent upon the woodcutter who cuts the trees, the paper mill, the people who make the paper out of the trees, the trucking company that brings the paper into our towns, the people who sell the paper, and so on. So we are all interdependent. And in that context, I would just like to say that the non-traditional spiritual communities in Tompkins County, Seneca County, Ontario, and in this particular region are interdependent on each other, as are the traditional communities. And I'd like to just say that there are so many people doing wonderful work in our spiritual communities. And my work is just one of many. And it's an honor to be here on the show today, but there are so many of us who network, work together, are friends, have known each other for many, many years, and are doing work together as a community. And I just want to say that I honor those folks, and they are my friends, and we all work together to do what we're doing. Great. And there's so much good work going on.
Great. But we're happy to have you with us.
Thanks.
You traveled to Dharamsala in 1990 in order to write your book about the Dalai Lama in exile. How did you get involved in this project?
Well, I'll tell you, that book was just a gift from I don't know where, because my intention in going to Dharamsala was not that book in particular. I was doing some research on the sacred Tibetan dances. I was a dancer, actually, for many years. I had been studying classical ballet. I was a very serious student of ballet through my youth, and was actually a graduate of Interlaken Arts Academy, and was a serious dance teacher and dancer. And in subsequent years, I became a very serious student of Eastern philosophy and meditation. And when I saw the sacred dances of Tibet, suddenly something clicked for me about dance as a sacred activity and Eastern philosophy. And I began doing research on the sacred dances, and I wrote a paper on the dances, which was accepted by the Society of Dance History Scholars for delivery at a conference in Hong Kong. When I planned to go to Hong Kong, I felt that there was a message for me to do further research on the dances, so I planned an extended stay in Dharamsala to do research on the dances. At that time, however, I was a freelance journalist for the Ithaca Journal doing articles on dance, the arts, theater, and so on. And I met Bill Warren, who is a photographer for the Ithaca Journal. He heard about the work I was going to be doing in Dharamsala and asked me if I wanted to work with him on a book project. He had visited Ladakh and had been taking photos of the beautiful Tibetan-related culture and wanted to do more work on that culture.
So he was actually taking pictures, and he invited you to write the text?
He invited me, yes, to work with him on the text. So the book idea evolved from there.
It's a beautiful book.
It's gorgeous, and Bill is an extremely gifted photographer, and he has thousands of photos from that trip. I went on ahead with my family. I had three children at the time, and my children and I were there for 6 months. Bill joined us later for his part of the project. I showed him around the community, pointed out some of the more important pieces which might be necessary for a comprehensive book on the exile community in Dharamsala.
Set up some time. Can you tell us a little bit about the exile community, a little
history? Yes. In 1959, Tibet was invaded by the communist Chinese. His Holiness the Dalai Lama and his community were forced into exile. Many people know at this time that there was mass genocide of the Tibetan people and of the beautiful monasteries and of the culture. And as part of that exile and exodus, the Tibetan community moved into Dharamsala, which is a hillside community that had been abandoned by the British in northern India. And they live there now in exile with a government in exile, and live there quite successfully and quite happily. Of course, in the early years, there was a great deal of poverty, and many people died and lived, you know, in dire conditions. Over the years, there has been a great deal of improvement with help from the outside world, and the tradition.
How big is this village?
There are many, you know, several thousand, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people now. It has grown with help from the outside world, and conditions have improved.
And there's room for it to continue.
And
to
there's
grow?
Room to grow, and now hotels have been built, and the community expands. Mm-hmm. There is what's called the Tibetan Children's Village, where orphan children live and are taken care of. My children went to school in the Tibetan Children's Village for the 6 months that we lived there. So Bill and I captured the community in the early 90s when things were more established and the community could be captured in book form, where the tradition was still very strong. But there was beginning to be some flourishing of some modernity. So we, I think, caught the exile community at a time of growth.
You know, you say you studied classical ballet and you taught dance, and you said that after meeting the Dalai Lama that you came to an understanding that you couldn't continue pursuing a career in the arts. Tell us about that.
Yes, my life changed in an instant with my first private audience with the Dalai Lama, which is not an easy thing to arrange, but based on our book and on my research, we were granted an audience. I have to say that the Dalai Lama is what everyone says he is: gracious, warm, completely open, with a warmth and humor that is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. My life changed without reflection, and what I mean by that is that I walked out of there and said, this has to change in my life, instantly, without going to my room and thinking about it. I am no longer an artist. I have to be in the human services. Now, I can't say that's for everyone, and that's what everyone's life has to do. But based on what's called the Bodhisattva vow, I had to move into human service work. I'm now an addictions counselor, no longer a ballerina. It's a far cry from being a dancer. But that's what I had to do.
Uh-huh. And did you feel that coming perhaps before you met the Dalai Lama and just didn't know what to put your finger on or
it was leading? My personal life was involved with mental illness in my family, and I can say that openly and clearly now. It's a biological disease that many of my family members suffered, and that's part of my interest in Eastern studies. I saw that there are darknesses in the human mind and in the human soul that I wanted to understand. Not only did I want to look at the bright and beautiful in the human condition, but I wanted to investigate the darkness that humans suffer. And so I knew that I wanted to pursue the human mind in its fullest. So for my own personal growth, there was something that I needed to understand. Mm-hmm. But at that moment of meeting the Dalai Lama, I knew that I had to investigate for the benefit of others what the human condition is, and that was the turning point in my life. So there I was asking him if I could study the Tibetan sacred dance tradition so that I could share it with the rest of the world, but as I walked out the door, I suddenly realized that I had to go into a field where I could be helping others on a different scale. So it was a very, very meaningful turn of events in my life. And of course, coming back home, there was a great deal of change and growth that I had to undergo in order to fulfill that.
Did you ever consider going into psychology instead of the Eastern philosophies? I know you come from a Jewish family.
Right.
Just wondering
where
the leap
I'm going now. Happened. That is what I do.
Uh-huh.
So yes, that's
so
what's
you are
taking
going into
place.
Psychology.
Yes,
uh-huh.
as well as my work with Wisdom's Goldenrod Center and the Women's Interfaith Institute.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going both tracks, uh-huh. and that's what I do. But first, before we go on with that, I want to mention that Bill Warren, who does work with the Ithaca Journal,
mm-hmm.
is working on a project now. He's traveling the world. He's been to many countries, and is working on a book on hiking the world.
Mm.
And that's become his life project. He's been visiting many continents and plans to put together a book on the various continents of the world and is working on a book on thoughts on hiking the world. So
that's great. And we did invite Bill to join us today, and he did decline. He's very busy.
Yes.
Tell us about the founding of the Wisdom's Goldenrod Center. Where is it? It's near
yes.
Watkins Glen, right?
It's near Watkins Glen in Schuyler County, the Hector area.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in 1972, by Anthony Damiani, and his descendants run the New Alexandrian Bookstore here in Ithaca. And the Wisdom's Goldenrod Center was founded through a bookstore in Ithaca, which was the American Brahmin Bookstore. And Anthony started that bookstore with his own books. Many were out of print and rare books. And those of us back in the early days would wander into the bookstore looking at these, at that time, strange and unusual books about Eastern thought, and we came together in the evenings and went to classes, crammed into the bookstore with this very dynamic teacher exposing us to thoughts that were unusual back in those days, and we found that something was binding us together as students. And we said, you know, we need a center. We need a place where we can freely study and not be jammed into, you know, this tiny little bookstore. So together we built Wisdom's Goldenrod Center for Philosophic Studies, which is a nonprofit educational organization, to study the world's traditions and to learn different techniques of meditation and to not focus on any one tradition. So Hinduism, Buddhism, the Greek philosophies, fields such as astrology, we have a women's study group that looks at Greek mythology and so on, are studied independently of each other and yet interconnected as sort of comparative studies. And they are based, primarily were originally based on the studies of Paul Brunton, who was Anthony's original teacher. So in the tradition of Eastern philosophy, a student-teacher relationship passed down. And Paul Brunton was one of the early students who traveled to India, Egypt, some of the Eastern countries, to find out for himself what these philosophies were all about. He was very popular back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, one of the first travelers to uncover these traditions and put them in Western terminology so that they made sense.
Can you do that for us, too, to tell us what some of the, when you talk about Buddhism traditions,
yes.
what are you talking about?
Well, let's start with Hinduism.
Okay.
In the Hindu tradition, they talk about the Atman, which is the higher self within, which is that spark within oneself, which we might call the soul, that one can turn to as the higher self.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Brunton termed it the overself, rather than calling it the Atman. So it's a term that we in the West can relate to, over self. Now, in Buddhism, they would say, well, there is no soul. They would have a different way of describing a way to turn within. And so there would be debate between the Hindus and the Buddhists. Mm. Is there an over-self or is there not an over-self? And we can use terminology that doesn't have to rely on former or rather foreign terms. And so at Wisdom's Goldenrod, we try to take these concepts, look at them from their traditional context, mm-hmm. but then put them in language that will make sense to a Westerner so that we can discuss them in a way that has context. And I just want to say that about 10 years after Wisdom's Goldenrod was formed, we made some connections to work as a publishing company, not as a publishing company, but with some friends from Wisdom's Goldenrod, and formed Larson Publications to publish Paul Brunton's books and to publish other books that were related to a Western way of understanding Eastern concepts. So we've been doing quite a bit of publishing work alongside of the many classes that we hold and other special events. I've been consistently involved in the Buddhism class. I do teach or lead the Buddhism class now, and I'd like to say about that that we present traditional Buddhist ideas, but we do a lot of personal sharing and a lot of outside the mainstream of Buddhism so that we're not strict, this is Buddhism. There's a lot of creativity involved in what we do.
You know, my concept of Buddhism is that you're supposed to let go of things. I don't know if that's a pretty simplistic term, but why do you think Westerners do in some ways have a hard time grasping what Buddhism is? And do we ever really get it?
Yeah, there are so many preconceptions.
I know.
I mean, when you say letting go, sure, there's letting go, there's detachment, but there's so much that comes before that. There's so much understanding that needs to take place before we can let go. How can we just let go?
And do you think Western people traditionally just don't have the patience?
I don't know that we don't have the patience.
To study the steps that one needs to take in order to do this?
You know, I think we just don't know how. Because people have patience to study their field, you know, to work in a certain job. People have patience. I think they just don't know where to begin. They pick up a book, they go to a class, they put it down, they say, I don't know how to do this.
And people were brought up in traditional religions, too, that they sometimes have to cleanse themselves of or learn how to reinterpret in order to follow through their lives. Yeah,
you're right. They may have had a bad experience with religion. There are all kinds of reasons.
But you don't. Did you consider Buddhism and Hinduism as a religion in regard to the Western version of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although things go through, you know, change. If you take Hinduism in a Hindu country and try to transplant it into America, it's going to look very different. And there's a lot of talk now about Western Buddhism. What is that? What does it look like? What will it look like? And it remains to be seen.
Yeah, that would be my question. What, you know, when you translate something from a different country, we see what's happening in Iraq in regard to the non-understanding of a culture and a religion. So I'm just wondering what the translations really are that come here in regard to these traditions. I wanted to ask you about... you're on the board of the Women's Interfaith Institute, and you are starting some discussion groups. And I want to talk to you about that in just one second.
Okay.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Nancy Rose Ritter. So let's talk about that, some of the stuff that you're going to be doing with the Women's Interfaith Institute. I know you're on the board, and let's talk about what you're going to be doing.
The Women's Interfaith Institute is very exciting. We are going to be starting a discussion group, an interfaith discussion group. It will be the first Wednesday of every month, starting July 6th. We will be opening it up for discussion for men and women to talk about their experiences within their various faiths, and also for those who are exploring faiths. And our first guest will be Saraswati Devi. She is coming directly from India. She's from a Brahmin Orthodox Hindu family, and she will be talking about how she has overcome her orthodoxy. She's working with mentally handicapped children through adults in India. She's coming through our friend Roxanne Gupta, and she is working on using traditional performing arts, both folk and classical dance and music and yoga, as therapy with these handicapped folks. And she has had to overcome the caste system and the difficulties of being an Orthodox Hindu in her work. So it's been very, very challenging for her, and especially with the financial difficulties over in India. She celebrates all the religious holidays from all of the cultures, including, you know, Christmas and whatever. And her belief is that all paths lead to the same goal. So that's very much in keeping with the interfaith ideal. And since we are a discussion group, there will be questions and answers from those in attendance, so she can address, you know, the various questions that will come up amongst those in attendance. But it will be a monthly discussion group. We will touch on every topic that comes up, whether
and
it's...
Are you going to come up with the topics, or are you going to let people...
No, the topics will come up organically from those in attendance. It may be grief and loss. It may be prayer. It may be pitfalls along the way to a spiritual path. It may be conflicts within spiritual groups. Could be any number of topics, but we'll let it come up from the group itself. Mm-hmm. And it will be meeting at the Seneca Falls Library, again, the first Wednesday of every month at 7.
Okay, and we will give some contact information at the end of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to ask you about the fact that you're an addictions counselor. What kind of concepts do you use in order to help people?
Primarily, strength-based model. That is that everyone comes into their addiction with strengths. We're not looking at weaknesses per se. Mm-hmm. Now, weakness, of course, will come into the overall idea of treatment, but let's look at the strengths. What do you have going for you? What's going to help you succeed in your life? What's going to bring you out of your addiction? And that goes along with your family dynamics, and that's going to be key to your recovery, because after all, you need your supports. You need your sober supports. If your family's not going to be there to support you, who is clean and sober in your life who is going to help you through this? So where are the strengths there? Who is going to be there for you? And maybe it is your spiritual community. And within addictions, there is a spiritual component, whatever your higher power may be, and that can be nature, that can be any number of things. So when we talk about spirituality, it doesn't necessarily mean God or Buddha or Jesus or whoever that may be. It can be any number of identified factors that one turns to that brings you to something beyond the ego, something stronger than the ego, something that will take you out of your pain and sorrow and suffering and bring you to a higher perspective.
And do you sometimes have people coming to you who actually need to find that something?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, addiction is known to be the factor that takes you to the lowest point in your existence. And people are looking for something to take them out of that. And they have reached bottom, what's calling, you know, called hitting bottom. And they really sometimes resist it. You know, that's the last thing they want is someone to tell them what's going to be the answer. Mm-hmm. But they're seeking something higher, and no one has the answer for them. They have to look in the depths of their own heart. Mm-hmm. But any little clue will be welcomed in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry about this culture in which we are actually encouraging people to take drugs for most of their problems?
Well, you know, isn't it a mixed message?
It is.
Don't do drugs, but go to the drugstore.
Yeah,
and
get some Prozac if you're not feeling... You know, I mean, some people do need these
of course.
Drugs. It obviously has been a real...
Of course, we're talking
great
about
thing
chemical...
for many people with many problems that were life-threatening and so on. But it almost seems like we have transferred the addictive culture into another level of an addicted culture that we are saying is okay,
right?
In some ways. And as an addiction counselor, what do you think about that?
I think it's a very difficult, complicated situation to sort through.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up and I was told that my mother had schizophrenia, I didn't understand. I felt that she was a victim of society.
Mm.
And it took me a long time to realize that she had a biochemical disorder. In fact, when she came to me and said, I'm going to go off my medications, at first I said, no, Mom, you've been on them a long time. You really need to stay on them. But she persisted, and it was the 60s, and I said, okay, let's see what it's like. And as I saw, within a 24-hour period, the hallucinations begin to take over.
Oh my.
I began to realize that, no, this was a biochemical situation. And when she went back on the medications and the hallucinations abated, I realized that we were talking about something biological.
Mm-hmm.
So when people say to me, I don't need my medications, I say, well, wait a minute. Yeah, you do. You need to stabilize medically.
Mm-hmm.
You do need this medication.
Yeah, a lot of people feel like they start feeling better and I'm great and I'm on top of it now, and they forget that the reason that they are is because of the chemical help.
Exactly.
You can put it that way, I suppose.
So when addicted individuals start to self-medicate on illegal substances, well, yeah, maybe they are looking for some medical answer, but something off the street is not going to solve that problem. It needs to be monitored. It needs to be looked at from a medical standpoint. So it's complicated. It's not easy to figure out on one's own. And then, of course, we have many naturopathic and natural remedies that can help people to a certain degree. It depends on the nature of the illness, the extent of the problem, and what sources are going to be beneficial at what level. So there's a holistic need to really
You know what I really wanted to ask you? I want to ask you, was your family upset or absolutely shocked when you went from Jewish religion into some of these other religions?
Not in the least.
Really?
No. In fact, my father went through conversions of his own, and different family members explored in their own ways. Certain family members were shocked and not happy. Others were open-minded, so I ran the gamut from that perspective. But I did come from a prominent Jewish family that contributed to, you know, a large library in Syracuse, and it was a very Orthodox Jewish.
And do you no longer follow any Jewish traditions?
You know, I when my daughter died, I turned to Judaism in a very strong and profound way. And I feel very connected to Judaism on one level. But on another level, it doesn't answer certain questions for me. And I do consider myself Buddhist. But it doesn't mean that I have rejected Judaism or that I feel disconnected from Judaism. So I can't say that I have left the fold of Judaism.
And you're still welcomed warmly if you go to synagogue.
And I am, but I have to say that some people don't realize that I have turned to Buddhism. It's an interesting,
walking into the synagogue.
In some ways, you know,
that's interesting.
It's funny. But my life has really become my own, and so I'm not holding secrets, but I'm also my own person. And
do you think it is valuable for people to be able to take some of the traditions that they were brought up with? If they're not answering all the questions, would you encourage people, I assume, to explore other
Absolutely.
Paths?
You know,
and you can still take from all. You don't have to reject necessarily.
Not at all. When I met with the Dalai Lama, he said to me, make absolutely certain that Judaism is not your path. Explore it fully first. And then, if you feel a call to be a Buddhist, be a Buddhist. And he says that repeatedly to people. He never tells people to convert to Buddhism. He always encourages people to follow the path they were born in, because there is a strong sentiment that you were born there for a reason. You were born in a time and place that calls to you, and that all paths have their validity to certain personalities at a certain time and a certain place in history, and that all religions are valid for their time and place. And if you are called to another path at a certain time for yourself, then be true to that. So I explored my roots to the fullest, and I have utmost respect for that. But I found that Buddhism took me to a new level and a new purpose in my own life.
That's wonderful, actually.
Thank you.
Can you give us some contact information that we can share with our listeners in case they want to get in touch with
you? Yes. I think the best way, if people are interested in purchasing the book, Living Tibet, or if they would like to come to the Buddhism study group at Wisdom's Goldenrod, or if they're interested in the discussion group with the Women's Interfaith Institute, all of that, I can be reached through my email address, which is nanci@clarityconnect.com.
Great. Thank you so much for being with
Thank
us,
Thank you.
Nancy.
It was a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.